From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Madness, madness everywhere, I tell you, and in sports, too. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest NCAA tournament developments and a conversation with a rare four-year Connecticut Husky who didn't earn a title under Gino Auriemma's tutelage. Also, tiny Mercyhurst College goes up against women's ice hockey powerhouse Minnesota. Also ahead, two Indian cricket players travel to Florida, where the Pittsburgh Pirates hope to transform them from bowlers into pitchers.
Here were two kids that were blank slates with a work ethic that just was beyond anything I'd ever seen. And it was just a matter of could they catch up to kids that were their age from around the world that had played baseball their whole life.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On day two of the men's NCAA basketball tournament, sixth-seeded Marquette made enough late free throws to hold off 11th-seed Utah State. Marquette won that game by a point, 58-57. Number six-seed West Virginia was not as fortunate. Having come back from an early deficit, they fell to number 11-seed Dayton, 68-60. Number 3-seed Syracuse displayed no ill effects from the 7 overtimes the team had played in the last two games of the Big East Conference Tournament, and they beat 14-seed Stephen F. Austin 59-44. Hardly seems fair, does it? One guy against the whole Syracuse team. Pittsburgh, a number 1-seed, had an unexpectedly tough time shaking off number 16-seed East Tennessee State, which trailed by only half a dozen points with 5 minutes left in the game. Pitt did prevail, 72-62. Various other favorite aggregations found the going considerably easier. Missouri, a number 3-seed, shook off Cornell and won their game by 19 points, and Kansas, a number 3-seed, beat 14-seed North Dakota State by 10, 84-74. It is perhaps an exaggeration to say that everybody in the U.S. is paying close attention to the NCAA tournament, but apparently it's no exaggeration at all to conclude that the president is following the action. On Tuesday, Barack Obama acknowledged same.
We've got the NATO summit, but we are going to be trying to catch as much of this as possible. Air Force One does have DirecTV.
You can find President Obama's picks on ESPN's website. They strike me as surprisingly conservative. As usual, the draw dismayed some of the teams who felt they should have been included in the tournament and no doubt delighted others seated more highly than they thought they might be. But the current economic situation made the job of those figuring out who would be playing whom and where even more difficult than usual, at least according to NCAA Men's Basketball Committee Chair Mike Sleeve.
It was very difficult. This was a very, very difficult bracketing process. And it was made more difficult because we're all very sensitive to the economy and what it means. And we kept a lot of teams close to home.
The committee couldn't work that out for everyone. Cal State Northridge and the University of California at Berkeley had to travel to Kansas City to be bounced off the dance floor in one game. One might assume that a team playing its first-round game would be thrown off by the absence and brief hospitalization of their head coach, but if the team in question is the University of Connecticut men, one would be wrong. Without Jim Calhoun, the Huskies squeaked by Chattanooga 103-47. Assistant coach George Blaney was not surprised.
If you go back through his history, that's why all his players are so good, and when they get to the pros, they even get better. Because he teaches them how to work. They were prepared to play well.
And if you go back through history, you'll find that Coach Calhoun missed a first-round game because of illness in 1999 and left a second-round game in 2004 after becoming ill. UConn won both tournaments. Anybody else sense a pattern here? Meanwhile, according to Chattanooga coach John Shulman, who was on the sideline Thursday, his players were proud to have had the opportunity to participate in the tournament.
Nothing to be ashamed of ending your season in Philadelphia in the NCAA tournament. We just expected more, and that's why I said we dreamed it. Whether that's right or wrong, I ain't ashamed of that. I think if you can't have dreams, someone needs to shoot me.
That would seem extreme, even to those of us who've already seen our brackets shot full of holes. May you be luckier from here on in than I have been so far. Mel Thomas played 4 years of basketball for Geno Auriemma at the University of Connecticut and never won a national championship. Had she started a year earlier, she'd have been a member of the Husky team that beat Tennessee for all the marbles. Had she started a year later, she'd have been on the current undefeated UConn team, which is favored to hand Auriemma his sixth championship. But in Heart of a Husky, the diary-style book she has written about her years at UConn, Mel Thomas doesn't sound as if she considers herself unlucky. She's currently playing professional basketball in Ireland, and she joins me now from the studios of WLR-FM in Waterford. Mel Thomas, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Very well, and you're very welcome. As you've watched UConn move through their undefeated 08-09 season, have you found yourself wishing that you were still there?
I kind of have a little bit. I mean, I'm so happy for all the girls, but it was just so great to be a part of it. And I feel like, you know, my season, my senior year, getting injured was just kind of cut short. So I kind of wish I could get that time back. But, you know, that's not the way things go.
You refer to UConn head coach Geno Auriemma as, quote, a Philadelphia smart aleck and the greatest master of sarcasm. At one point, he told some of your teammates that he didn't know why they didn't go home and kill themselves after they'd played particularly badly. But how often has he lost or alienated great players with that approach?
Well, Coach Auriemma was the greatest coach that I've ever played for. And he's really, really hard on his players, but I think that's just what makes him such a great coach. And he always has their best interest at heart. And I don't know if everybody can see that when they're just watching from the sidelines and they see him, you know, looking like a raving lunatic. But he just, I mean, he really does everything for a purpose. And everything that he does builds confidence and instills confidence in his players. And that's what makes him so good out there on the court.
Last season, a couple of your teammates were benched because their grades were not up to the coach's standards. They were eligible to play according to university standards, but Coach Auriemma wasn't satisfied. Given the level of control that Auriemma has and the amount of time that players spend pretty much exclusively with each other, did being on the team ever feel like being in a cult?
A cult? No, definitely not a cult. But they do value, you know, a lot of things in their program, and it's about being good people and doing the right thing and presenting yourself well, treating people with respect. And I think it's something that really reflects who you are as a UConn player, and we carry ourselves with class, with pride, and I think that's kind of what it's all about. It's something that you want to be a part of, so you want to make yourself be that type of person.
You say at one point in the book that being a basketball player at UConn is like having a full-time job. Did you ever find yourself envying students who had more options regarding the various opportunities at UConn?
Not really, because I still feel like I got to experience, you know, all the regular student activities. And you might not get to do it every day. You might get to go out, you know, once every couple of weeks and not 5 nights a week. But I think that makes it even more special, because the times that we had to go out, the times that we had to do normal student things, it was, you know, more of a privilege than something that we do every single day. And I don't know, it keeps you busy, but I think the fact that we were so busy, it, you know, you stay on track, and you know you only have an hour to do this assignment, or you have 2 hours to write this paper, and so you sit down and you get it done. So I think the busier I was, the more I was able to keep myself on track and do things right.
You were a senior when Maya Moore, UConn's most celebrated current player, was a freshman. Could you see right away how dominant she would be?
Definitely. The summer before she even started school in pickup games, I knew she was a special player. You could just tell by her work ethic and how confident she was as a freshman just stepping out on campus that she was going to be something really, really special. And, you know, her athletic ability speaks for itself, but just the type of person she is and the mentality that she has is what's going to make her so good.
At UConn, of course, the team flies to games on a chartered jet, and they play in tournaments in exotic locations. They go to places like the Virgin Islands. How does playing pro basketball in Ireland compare to that experience?
It's a lot different, because they definitely don't have the sponsorship or the money here that they did that we did at UConn. So we don't get, you know, the chartered flights or the meals or all the gear. We got a hoodie and we bus to games. Sometimes we take cars. I mean, it's a lot different here. I mean, there's some places, if you're like Seward Diana and you're in Russia, I know they're getting catered to there. But I mean, all that is nice, but it's not that important. What really is important to me is just being out on the court and playing the game that I love.
I read that you had been offered a contract to play for the Seattle Storm next summer. Do you have plans to join various UConn veterans in the WNBA?
I hope so. I'm going to head out there for training camp in May, so that's the plan.
How tough do you think it's going to be to make the transition from Ireland to the WNBA rather than directly from a top college program the way so many WNBA players have done?
Yeah, my situation is a little bit different because, you know, I had my surgery and I had to get back into playing. But I think coming over here to Ireland and, you know, getting back into the flow of things really helped me out. And I'm going to go back to UConn's campus after I leave here and, you know, work out with the girls and get ready for training camp. So I feel like I'm ready. I feel like I've improved and I'm back stronger than ever from my knee injury. So I'm really excited about the opportunity.
Given that UConn is undefeated this year and they swept through the Big East tournament and won the final so by such a lopsided score, is there any way they don't win the NCAA tournament?
I mean, I'm pretty biased, and I'm going to say no. I think that they definitely are going to win, but I don't know. I think all year they've proved that they are the best team in the country, but the tournament is different than, you know, proving that you're the best team over the entire season. It's six games and you have to prove that you're the best team over those six games. So I think they're the best team, but it's a matter of doing it in the next couple of weeks.
Mel Thomas, currently playing for the Waterford Wildcats, graduated from the University of Connecticut last spring. She's the author of Heart of a Husky, Determination, Perseverance, and a Quest for a National Championship, published by Keen Custom Media. And she joined me from Waterford, Ireland. Mel, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, no problem. Thanks for having me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Half the crowd at last weekend's rugby match between Nottingham Rugby Club and Exeter Chiefs was oddly quiet. Actually, not oddly, since 1,000 of the 2,000 spectators on hand for the game were inflatable dolls provided by the Nottingham company called Airheads. As a local firm, we're keen to support Nottingham Rugby in their quest to raise the profile of the club, said Airheads director Lee Harris, who hoped the presence of his plastic fans might encourage more spectators with a pulse to show up for the following week's match against Leeds. Unhappily, the Airheads, who are usually employed as extras in movies and TV commercials, were useless in terms of the outcome of the match against Exeter, which Nottingham lost 15-14. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, it's the upstart Lakers against the powerful Gophers in the Frozen Four hockey tournament. But first, Alonzo Trier plays or practices basketball 7 hours a day. He's been doing that for 4 years. A nationally recognized scouting service has named him the best player in his age group for the last several years, so it's no wonder Alonzo Trier has received questionnaires from colleges interested in his talents. except that Alonzo Trier is 13 years old. In tomorrow's Sunday New York Times Magazine, Michael Sokolov tells the story of this player and how he represents the way college coaches are expanding their search for talent into the junior high and grade schools. Mr. Sokolov joins me now from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be with you.
How did you first hear about Alonzo Trier, and what did you hear?
Well, I was looking to write about this world of what's sometimes called grassroots basketball and sort of casting about for characters. And Alonzo Trier, you know, in this world is a pretty well-known kid, and you don't have to go very far before people say, oh, you should check out Alonzo Trier, and he's rated by Hoop Scoop, which is one of the leading scouting services, and some of these other services. And I went out to the Junior Phenom camp in San Diego last summer and looked at him play and met him for the first time out there.
Before we get into his specific talents on the basketball court, how old was Alonzo when his clothing line was established, and how did that happen?
I suppose that was probably a year or two ago. Alonzo just turned 13, and Seattle, for whatever reason, happens to be a hotbed for young basketball talent. So there's an entrepreneurial designer, manufacturer out there who wants to put, you know, personally branded clothes plus the brand of his company on some of the better players, because he knows that, you know, they travel the circuit. They're looked up to. They are sort of walking billboards or possible viral advertisers for his brand.
So are there actually 10 and 11-year-olds out there at AAU tournaments saying, I want to be like Alonzo?
You know, I think there are. I was at a tournament with him, the camp actually in San Diego, and I'm talking to him, and a father walks up and interrupts our conversation and says, excuse me, can you take a picture with my son? Who was about Alonzo's age, by the way. And Alonzo's a nice kid. He says, sure. Snaps the picture, and the father says to Alonzo, thank you, brother. You're a role model. Which, you know, I just stood there and thought, my goodness, this is pretty interesting.
Like lots of kids his age and younger, Alonzo plays AAU basketball. He lives near Seattle, but he plays in tournaments in Texas and California, as well as on the East Coast. And you say the AAU's practices, quote, mock traditional definitions of amateurism. How so?
Well, there's just a lot of money flowing through the whole system. Teams, individual teams, the best teams are recruited or coveted by the sneaker companies, Nike and Adidas, by the apparel companies like Under Armour, and they want to fund these teams so that the apparel can go to the kids, and they can sort of bind these kids or attract these kids as sort of like lifelong, you know, Nike users or Adidas users. And the hope on these companies' parts is that, you know, somewhere in the mix is the next LeBron James, the next Kobe. So if Alonzo Trier, you know, gets to the promised land, you know, he's a possible Nike endorser.
We ought to talk a little bit about how good this kid is as a basketball player. What in his game leads people to think he might be the next LeBron James?
You know, that's a great question. And I stood on the sideline, and I think I know a little bit about basketball. And I tried to answer that question. How much is hype and how much is reality? First of all, he's not that big. You know, he's about average, a little bigger than average for his age, but he's not that tall for somebody with elite basketball ambitions. He's a great ball handler. He's a terrific shooter. He's fast. I'm not sure that he's lightning fast. I'm not sure that he's a blur, as one of his coaches put it to me. So, you know, the question of how good is Alonzo? You know, I think he's awfully darn good. Is he as good as everybody thinks he is? I hope so, because he's planning on it.
At that Junior Phenom camp, and I love the name, by the way, you found a program that listed not only the heights and hometowns of the participants, but also their chosen nicknames. Run some of those by me and tell me what, if anything, they reveal.
Well, the ones that struck me were variations on the word money. There was a G Money, a K Money, a Cash Money, and somebody who just called themselves Money. And
I shouldn't be laughing at this because, in a way, it's very distressing. But, you know, hey, there we are.
Well, Bill, I think if you want to look at it innocently, you know, sometimes when you're on the basketball court and somebody takes a shot and it always goes in, people say, well, he's money.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose we could look at it that way, but I suspect it had a little to do with the more common definition of money, as in cash money.
Yeah, I like that cash money, just in case there should be any confusion. I'll say it twice. How was the quality of basketball at these camps where all these alleged phenoms are gathered?
Appalling. It was what I would expect to see when you have a bunch of kids playing for themselves and playing to be noticed. They shot endlessly. Very few kids passed the ball. They didn't move without the ball. They didn't play team basketball. So when I watched this camp and I watched the quality of play, and, you know, all the young NBA players and a lot of the best college players came from this environment, to me, it was telling me, okay, well, here's the reason. Hmm. They all made their bones in this setting, you know, these kinds of settings. So, of course, when you go off to higher levels, you're not a team player.
Having spent the time that you have spent on this story, I can't imagine that you won't follow the progress or lack of same of Alonzo Trier. At what point in his development do you think you'll be able to say, oh my gosh, he is as good as everybody said, or whoa, he didn't grow and it didn't happen?
I suppose the first marker will be when he's about ready to go to college. You know, if the NBA is the goal, you know, that'll be another marker. And, you know, I should point out, I can easily be wrong. I don't hold myself out as a talent scout. I did a story several years ago on IMG Academies in which I followed some young baseball players. And I was certainly as skeptical. But I must tell you that I did look one up the other day, and he was a fifth-round draft choice of the Toronto Blue Jays. So it works out sometimes.
Michael Sokolov wrote the article entitled Alonzo Trier is in the Game, which will appear in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Michael, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Great to be on with you.
There is a sort of pecking order among the college sports tournaments this weekend. The NIT is playing in the shadow of the NCAA's March Madness. The NCAA women will get a lot less attention than the men, and the women of the NCAA Frozen Four get even less attention than that. Tomorrow in Boston, the 2009 Women's College Ice Hockey Champion will be determined. In the first semifinal yesterday, Wisconsin topped Minnesota Duluth. In the second semifinal, well, only a game's Karen Given was there, and we'll let her tell us about that game.
It's Thursday afternoon, and the women of Mercyhurst College are taking the ice by twos and threes inside Boston University's Aganis Arena. A player dumps a bucket of pucks onto the rink, and another shouts, "Somebody take a picture." After losses in the quarterfinals for 4 years in a row, this is the first time the Lakers have made it to the NCAA Frozen Four. Mercyhurst's semifinal opponent, Minnesota, has been winning women's ice hockey championships since before the NCAA sanctioned the sport in 2001. The Gophers won two more championships in 2004 and 2005 and made the Frozen Four six out of the 9 times it's been held. Even their uniforms, in strong maroon and gold with the graphic M on the chest, are intimidating next to the mild-mannered green, blue, and white of Mercyhurst. Mercyhurst College enrollment is listed at just over 3,000 students. Minnesota has more than 4,000 faculty members and 40,000 undergrads. Sound like an unfair fight? Minnesota head coach Brad Frost doesn't think so.
I don't know. I think it's very fair considering they've got a great hockey team. And, you know, that's what's so great about the game of hockey is it, you know, each team has 20, 23 players, and it's not necessarily the size of the school, but the talent that you have on the ice. And so I think fair is fair.
Mercyhurst is on a streak, having won 16 in a row and 27 of its last 28 games. Coach Frost says his team has prepped hard to play Mercyhurst, but under pressure from the press, can Captain Gigi Marvin answer a simple question about her semifinal opponents?
Yeah, could you tell me, do you know where Mercyhurst is located? It's a tricky one. close to the Canadian border.
That's correct. Erie, Pennsylvania.
Erie, Pennsylvania.
It's not an easy one.
While Mercyhurst might not be the most well-known school in the NCAA, head coach Michael Sisti says Lakers women's ice hockey and their five consecutive quarterfinal berths is one of the most well-known sports storylines in Erie, Pennsylvania.
We get so much support. We may get more support than any college team in women's hockey. Even though we're small, we get TV headlines, we get newspaper headlines, we get great coverage, and so many people have been pulling for us, and our team's played great in those games. We just haven't been able to break through, so I think I was really just happy for all them because there was so much excitement in the air and so many people at the game, you know, pulling for us.
Sure, the University of Minnesota might boast 375,000 living alumni, but Mercyhurst has borrowed a local high school band and dressed them up in Lakers hockey jerseys for Friday night's game. And the Mercyhurst Spirit Club, in matching blue t-shirts, has taken position behind the team bench. Minnesota starts off with a quick goal, and Mercyhurst answers back with not one, not two, but three goals before the end of the first period. As Mercyhurst pulls further and further away, the Spirit Club gets more spirited. Spirit Club member Steve Faber holds an enormous school flag, and despite arriving earlier today after a long drive, he's not too tired to wave it.
We actually chartered a bus up here. We're going to go back, and then there's a couple groups of us that are going to come back on Sunday, God willing, you know.
Wait, so you've come here all the way today. How long did it take you?
9 hours.
And then you're going to turn around and go back another 9 hours?
That's right.
That's some spirit, man.
That's all the spirit we got.
A 3-1 lead at the end of the first period might be encouraging to some, but Nancy Drennan, mom of Mercyhurst backup goalie Courtney Drennan, isn't ready to call the game in favor of the Lakers.
No, we've got to have a strong second period and hang on. Minnesota's a very strong team with some very skilled players, and we'll have to play a hard three periods to win. You never know, they can come out and one goal can change things. I'd like to see, I won't feel safe till we have a 4-goal lead.
One Mercyhurst parent suggests that he won't be happy until his team is ahead by 6. By the end of the second period, Nancy Drennan has her 4-goal lead, but it doesn't last long. Minnesota comes back strong, and with less than 2 minutes to go in the third period, shaves the lead to 1. The Lakers hold on, just barely. As the fans count down the game's final moments, they're probably not thinking about the competition ahead on Sunday. In the finals tomorrow, Mercyhurst will meet Wisconsin, a slightly smaller school of just 29,000 undergrads. While Mercyhurst made school history by getting to the Frozen Four, Wisconsin has made NCAA history as the only team to make the Frozen Four final game for 4 consecutive years. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. Francis German, who listens to Only a Game on WFYI in Indianapolis, has something in common with Keith Allen, who hears the program on WLRN in Miami. They both know that Morehouse College is in Atlanta, not Alabama. So do a lot of other listeners who got in touch. I carelessly relocated the venerable institution during my conversation last week with Donnie Tindall, the head coach of the men's basketball team at Morehead State University, which is in Kentucky, I hope. Last week, I also called Austin P. Austin Pay, for which I apologize as well. Joe Ritchie, who listens to the Only a Game podcast in Hong Kong, enjoyed that conversation with Donnie Tindall. He got a kick out of the fact that in his discussion of Kentucky basketball, Coach Tindall celebrated the University of Kentucky and failed to even mention Louisville. Mr. Ritchie wrote, "I suspect Louisville folks won't be too happy about what they heard, assuming they listened to your great show." Regarding my conversation last week with Gene Rhodes, the co-author of an authorized biography of Manny Ramirez, Peter Schiffsky, who hears the program on KNOW in Minnesota, wrote how sad it is that man-child Manny Ramirez has so many people around him, including the authors of the book Becoming Manny, who do nothing to help him grow up. Instead, all of his childishness is praised as just Manny. I bet the authors wouldn't want their children to grow up like Manny. Last week, Charlie Pierce suggested that if the Royals left Kansas City, perhaps nobody would care. Karen Hacker, who hears the program on KCUR in Kansas City, begs to differ. Just because the Royals have only been around for 40 years does not mean that we do not love them every bit as much as Cubs and Sox fans love their teams, she wrote. My sainted grandmother never missed a game, and I am sure she is still rooting for them in heaven. We, too, have faith that this year will be our year. 2 weeks ago, we told you about an adaptive rowing event adjacent to the Charles River in Boston. Two of the competitors with whom I spoke, one with prosthetic legs, the other in a wheelchair, concluded their conversations with me by saying, "Life is good." Vicky Chase, who hears Only a Game on WEVO in New Hampshire, wrote to say, "The cheerful slogan, 'Life is good,' has always made me feel cynical, but when the two women athletes used that sentiment, it was inspirational." You can comment on the program by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. You can write us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Sunday River Ski Resort, Maine, featuring 131 trails spread across 8 mountain peaks with 92% snowmaking coverage. Learn more at sundayriver.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals. Locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
No nudity, no G-strings or thongs. Violation of this requirement leads to immediate disqualification. So reads the rulebook of the United States Pole Dancing Federation, and at the national championships in New York, no competitor wanted to risk expulsion. Though some of them wore 5-inch heels, costumes were modest, at least by the standards associated with pole dancing before it became a popular aerobic workout and a competitive sport. After each competitor had engaged in a 60 to 90 second round of compulsory moves and a 3 to 5 minute optional round featuring original routines, the judges huddled for 10 minutes to consider such matters as execution, transition, difficulty, and flexibility. The winner, Janine Butterfly, if that really is her name. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, meet the baseball-playing Indians from India. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Round one of the men's NCAA basketball tournament got underway on Thursday. The earliest game nearly provided one of the biggest upsets. Does Memphis learn from its near ouster at the hands of mighty Cal State Northridge?
I think they probably do. I mean, they were rescued by Robert Sally, who averaged 4 points a game during the regular season and got 35 and pulled their bacon out of the fire against the Matadors. That was really quite something, apparently. At the other venues, people were waiting for the scores to come roll in, which is the nice thing about this tournament.
Chattanooga got off to a blazing 2-0 start against UConn, but the euphoria didn't last for long as the Huskies won their first-round game by 56 points, even without their ailing head coach. Maybe they should just keep Jim Calhoun home for the duration.
Well, I don't know. I had to check twice to make sure that was a men's game and not a woman's game.
But UConn being ahead by 56.
Yeah, George Blaney, an old friend of mine from Worcester, Mass., former coach at Holy Cross, managed to boot the Huskies home ahead of the Mocs, who apparently just got one complete case of stage fright.
Were you surprised to learn this week that tweeting had made its way into the NBA thanks to Charlie Villanueva of the Milwaukee Bucks?
More stuff that Red Auerbach didn't have to worry about. Charlie Villanueva was Twittering or tweeting or whatever you do at halftime of a game against the Celtics. Challenged himself, by the way, by tweeting, "I got to step up," then actually did, but his coach doesn't think it was a good idea. Scott Skiles has told him no more halftime Twittering.
Given the amount of hype Tiger Woods' return to golf has generated, you would think that everybody would be glad to see him back on the links, but some Australians are not, because their tax money will make up half of Tiger's $3 million appearance fee for November's Australian Masters tournament. This is some stimulus plan.
This is really crazy. I don't know what kind of politicians they have in Australia, but when we sit, we're over here arguing about subsidizing baseball stadiums. They're over there arguing about subsidizing athletes.
This week, Lance Mackey won his third straight Iditarod Trail sled dog race. Is it just me, or is it ironic that the winner of the world's most famous sled dog race gets a truck?
Well, if there's any justice in the world, the first person to get to ride in the back of the truck are the dogs.
Korea will play Venezuela tonight in the World Baseball Classic semis, and the U.S. will face Japan tomorrow. The U.S. has been losing players at an alarming rate to injury, but do they still have a shot?
I think they have a bit of a shot. The image of the World Baseball Classic in the United States has taken a real beating, what with Dustin Pedroia and Kevin Youkilis both becoming injured and going back to training camp with the Red Sox in bad shape. I think they have a shot. I don't think they have a shot at winning the thing, but I think they have a shot at playing for the finals.
National Football League Players Union has a new leader. His name is Demoris Smith. Good choice?
Apparently, he's very popular. He's young. He's trying to link the players with the people who are, you know, directing traffic and selling hot dogs in an attempt to get everyone on his side for the upcoming labor apocalypse, so we'll see.
This week we learned what young men and women aspiring to become ambassador to Ireland should do to qualify themselves for that position. You want to pass on that information?
Yes, you should own the Pittsburgh Steelers and win the Super Bowl and endorse Barack Obama before the Pennsylvania primary. Dan Rooney, the new ambassador to Ireland, one of the great jobs in all of the federal government.
Yeah, he's got the right name for it.
Sure.
Florida State head football coach Bobby Bowden has characterized the NCAA stripping 10 of the school teams of wins because of an academic fraud scandal. He characterized this as, quote, killing a flea with a hammer. Do you think he really meant killing my career win total with a hammer?
That's really remarkable that he's going to lose, you know, lose ground. It's very almost impossible to lose ground in a chase for the most wins. But I think, you know, given the nature of what happened at Florida State, the penalty was perfectly within reason.
National Hockey League has a new winningest goaltender. He's Martin Brodeur, and it sounds to me as if part of the celebration of that achievement didn't go quite as quickly or smoothly as Mr. Brodeur thought it might.
Yeah, he decided he was going to cut the net out of the goal and had a lot of trouble with it. It's a lot of cutting, actually. So he needed some help from his teammates. Good for Martin Brodeur.
On Thursday, Alex Ovechkin became the Washington Capitals' first player to score 50 goals in three straight seasons, but not quite everybody in the building was celebrating. Why was that?
Ovechkin put his stick down and warmed his hands over it as though it was too hot to move. Rick Tocchet, the interim coach of the Lightning, thought it was classless. He didn't like to see it in his building and stuff like that. But, you know, stop him if you don't like it. And by the way, Alex Ovechkin, a man who doesn't mind playing in Washington.
Exactly. And by the way, I watched the video of that, and I thought it was pretty funny.
Was it? I mean, it sounds like a great idea.
The 14th Major League Soccer season commenced on Thursday when the Seattle Sounders defeated the New York Red Bulls 3-0 before a crowd of over 32,000 people. The team has sold 22,000 season tickets for the current season. Could the Sonics-less Emerald City be the new American soccer hotbed?
Let's see how the season goes. It's got a it is a cutting edge place. It's a place that loves novelty, and this is the new thing in town. So let's see.
Charlie, we're going to end today's conversation with cricket news. Manny Ramirez has either been working on hitting pitches that bounce before they cross the plate, or he's been trying to recruit relievers for the Dodgers. How else to explain his batsmanship this week?
I don't have the faintest idea, but this is one of the greatest photos I've ever seen. If you haven't seen the picture of Manny in full cricket regalia, ferociously concentrating on the ball, you buy the ticket, you take the ride with Manny. But this is, if he's really, you know, seeking around for a sport in his retirement, who knows? Maybe we'll see him playing for the Dominican Republic in some Caribbean test match someday.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he glances to Silly Leg each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm ready for whatever when I step onto the field. No glove on my hand, man. Cricket keeps it real. Sitting in the covers waiting for a hot drop. From a big Jamaican bass to a I play the game with strive, so you know I will survive. Lots of fours and sixes, but I get to see your five. I've seen late glances, good offers and chases. Even seen batters take chances, the wickets wasted. I've seen many races, faces and places. Even took nets at Lord, for goodness gracious. I see busted noses, jaws and broken teeth. This game's about respect and etiquette, so never be.
I went with humble Morehead State. I figured that they would do great, since when I chatted on the show last week with Donnie Tindall, oh, he sounded like a guy who might lead his 16 seed to the bright and promised land and all the fun of knocking off a number one. I also thought that Illinois, a number 5 seed, would just toy with number 12 Western Kentucky, so perhaps I was unlucky. Did your jaw drop to the floor when the Illini lost by 4? This is not to say I'm dead, although perhaps when all is said and all is done as well, you'll see that bracket players who aren't me will do much better than I've done, and so I'm grateful it's in fun, and I'm not losing any money. Why's he looking at me funny, that guy who wrote down my picks? Has he, in his bag of tricks, some proof that I'm so big a fool that I would gamble in a pool and pit my witless, goofy guessing against my workmates? I'm not messing in these times of disappearing money with this stuff I'm hearing of the cash that can be won by those who do not play for fun, but back picks with potatoes. Gee, that would be no game for me. I've got kids attending college, nor have I sufficient knowledge to decide if UNC might humble Duke. I'll let that be a game for folks with cash to spare. I pick my teams, and sure, I care, but recreation's all I'm doing. Yet I fear that there is brewing some misunderstanding here. Did I not make it crystal clear that I was in it for the laughs? I've done no research, made no graphs. Ah, risky are the seas I sail. Okay, I lose. Checks in the mail. If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. The sight this week of baseball slugger Manny Ramirez in full cricket gear, taking swings at wicked googlies, created a cultural contrast so irresistible that few, let alone the staff of your humble public radio sports show, could ignore it. Less well publicized have been the efforts of two cricketers currently working out in Florida, with the hope of someday making Pittsburgh's big league squad as pitchers. Ron Schachter recently caught up with them at the Pirates minor league complex in Bradenton, Florida, and he has this story.
Earlier this month, millions around the movie-going world watched as the Oscar for Best Picture went to Slumdog Millionaire, an uplifting story of an orphan from the slums of Mumbai, India, who grows up through hard times to win big money and celebrity on a TV quiz show. At about the same time, two real-life athletes from India were working out on a backfield at Pirate City in Bradenton. The more modest reward for their success in the first season of the Indian reality show, The Million Dollar Arm. This weekly television contest was created by an American sports management company and featured aspiring pitchers with little baseball knowledge, but the ability to throw hard.
Let me welcome in our next contestant, Dinesh. 85, there we have the score. Whoa, very well done. 85 on
that. Dinesh Patel, who emerged with countryman Rinku Singh from more than 37,000 contestants, first heard about the show from their javelin coach.
He told me, you go out there, throw hard and win some money. But I go over there, throw 87 miles per hour and select for final Mumbai. And I go out there and throw hard 89 miles per hour, but I don't throw a strike. So I not win money. Rinku throw strike 87 miles per hour. He win money, $100,000.
That award was a windfall for 20-year-old Rinku, whose father made $25 a week as a truck driver in the Indian village of Badouin. Dinesh earned $2,500 as a runner-up, but the real prize for both young throwers was an extended trip to the United States last year to train with University of Southern California pitching coach Tom House, and an eventual tryout for interested major league clubs, including the Pirates, who signed them in December. Rinku Singh's repertoire today represents a quantum leap from his winning performance on the Million Dollar Arm, where he almost catapulted the baseball towards what looked like cardboard cutouts of a catcher and a waiting batter.
I have four pitches now. I throw a fastball, my fastball right now, 90-91. I have changeup. I throw breaking ball, and sometimes I throw a split finger.
The 19-year-old Patel adds that he and Singh have begun to master the transition from hurling javelins to throwing baseballs.
Javelin throwing, release point, angle up, and baseball, release point, angle down.
That's just one lesson in a comprehensive education. Patel and Singh hadn't seen a baseball game until they arrived in the States. And then they were thoroughly confused, wondering, for instance, why the shortstop didn't have his own base like the rest of the infielders. Pirates minor league pitching coach Michael Steele has had to impart what most American little leaguers take for granted.
The biggest thing that for both of them is just to understand the game of baseball. Outs, strikes, balls, counts, what hitters are trying to do when a guy's on first base. You know, where's he going to go? What's the situation with the guy on third and less than two outs?
And, of course, Steele adds, there are no brushback pitches in javelin throwing.
I mean, how do you talk to him about that? You know, I mean, there's another thing. You know, well, why am I going to throw at a guy? You know, why am I going to brush him back? Okay, well, then having to explain that. I mean, that's so far down the road for these guys.
He's also tried to explain that they don't need to address him as sir.
Singh Patel, not sir.
Why not?
My dad is sir. No, I'm not your dad.
You're not like sir?
I'm stealing.
I call sir. I like. You are coach.
There's less ambiguity when it comes to teaching the art of pitching. And Steele uses a combination of pantomime and short phrases to make his points. Today, he's trying to get Patel, a compact right-hander, to square his shoulders, and to get the taller left-handed Singh to arrange his hands correctly before throwing.
Relaxed. Relaxed hands. Okay? Don't squeeze it. Much better. Much better.
Back in India, Singh and Patel had been training for future spots as javelin throwers on the Indian Olympic team. And Steele says that their athletic prowess has made his job easier. USC pitching coach and former Major League hurler Tom House worked with the young pitchers for almost half a year. He notes that they also arrived with some valuable intangibles.
Here were two kids that were blank slates with a work ethic that just was beyond anything I'd ever seen. And it was just a matter of could they get enough game experience to catch up to kids that were their age from around the world that had played baseball their whole life.
Singh, meanwhile, wants to make one thing perfectly clear about his life. Even though his ticket out of India was through a reality TV show, he'd like to avoid being stereotyped.
No way. I saw movie. The movie's good, but we are not Slumdog Millionaire. Because I graduate high school, I live to my family, I have my own house. I'm not Slumdog Millionaire, I'm not Slumdog. I want just good baseball pitcher. That's it.
When the Pirates' rookie pitchers pair up during practice, Singh and Patel, roommates off the field, usually throw to each other, speaking in Hindi, although they've improved their English by watching American movies and Baseball Tonight. But for all the novelty of developing the first two professional baseball players from India, Pirates Director of Player Development Kyle Stark says that their career with the organization is no publicity stunt.
Any newly signed player, the odds are stacked against them, and I'm sure it's even greater so in this case. But we felt like both these young men had a chance to play in the big league someday, and ultimately the doors that could potentially be open here. Not that India is a hotbed of baseball talent, but that, you know, in a country of a billion people, as baseball continues to expand around the world, it could be, a potential talent source for us. And to be the first ones in there was appealing to us.
So far, it's the American rather than the Indian press that's covered Singh and Patel's fledgling baseball careers. Still, coupled with the even larger turnout for the second season of The Million Dollar Arm, their success could spark interest in a country that's long embraced baseball's older cousin, cricket. Singh and Patel have yet to throw to live hitters. After finishing extended spring training, they'll play the shortened season of Florida's rookie-level Gulf Coast League, which begins in mid-June. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Brian Fadham and from Wayne Brown at WLR in Waterford, Ireland. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from President Obama.
Air Force One does have DirecTV.
Can't you hear it? Yeah. The market's in free fall. Switch over to the dance. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.